Good afternoon, Bay Area, and welcome to the Sights and Sound Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. I'm your host, Janae Darden. On today's show, the San Francisco Ballet is getting ready for their production of Frankenstein. Then we'll pivot and pay homage to the late Dwayne Wiggins of Tony, 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 and why an Oakland author wanted to write a children's book about Star Trek's Nichelle Nichols, who, by the way, was also a ballet dancer. Iconic characters and legends. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sound Show with Janae Darden. The music world and the Bay Area are still grieving the passing of Dwayne Wiggins of Tony, Tony, Tony. A few weeks ago, the group posted on Facebook that Wiggins died from bladder cancer. He was 64. Tony, Tony, Tony formed their R&B funk trio in 1986 in Oaktown. And over the years, they have given us great songs like Anniversary, Whatever You Want, It Feels Good, and Slow Wine. I can't sing. I have no business singing. But there are so many songs they gave us, and they just brought so much joy to us. Wiggins was a producer, composer, entrepreneur, and he mentored people like Oakland artist Queen Imena. She toured with Tony here and in Africa. And the music you heard earlier is her song Oshun and features Dwayne Wiggins. Queen Imena performs Afrobeats among other genres of music, and she's also an educator and goodwill ambassador. And she's here to talk about the late great Dwayne Wiggins. Welcome, Queen Imena.
Greetings. Thank you so much for having me under, you know, challenging circumstances, but grateful to be here.
Yes. And my condolences to you, too, as well, since you worked so closely with Dwayne Wiggins. And I was on your Instagram and you said he was a mentor, a guide, an extended father, a collaborator, a friend, and he invested much in your success and greatness like no other. So that just tells me how significant he was in your life. How and when did you meet him?
Well, you know, definitely Dwayne's reputation preceded him. I'm very proud to be born and raised in Oakland. And so being born and raised in this great city, Tony, Tony, Tony was the soundtrack of my childhood. Mm-hmm. I can't actually imagine growing up without that. Yeah. And so grew up my entire life loving their music, loving Raphael Sadiq's music when he started his solo career. I'm hearing about Dwayne's work with Destiny's Child and all the amazing people he touched. Always made me proud when I thought of Tony, Tony, Tony and thought of Oakland. And so I had an opportunity to be around him a few times, but we actually got connected officially at the end of 2018 when Dwayne was taking Tony, Tony, Tony to Africa, to Nigeria, as part of the Year of Return that Ghana was doing. Mm. He had a lifelong dream of wanting to perform at Fela Kuti's Shrine, the New Africa Shrine in Lagos, Nigeria, and do a concert with his son, Shane Kuti. And so I was able to connect that for him through our mutual brother and advisor Field. And then from there, he got introduced to my work shortly after, and we started working together immediately.
Yeah, and you have, because you perform here and you perform overseas, so you have so many international connections, so you were able to, hook him up and bring him to perform in Nigeria. Wow, that's amazing. What about, you know, you've been around other major artists. What about him stood out to you?
Well, number one, he was just so cool. Like, he really is one of the most accomplished people that we had, that I knew of in our generation on the Oakland music scene. And so just based on different levels of interaction I had with other power players on the music scene, I thought, you know, I assumed he would be someone that would be, you know, hard to relate with, or, you know, I was kind of nervous about us connecting, like, wow, what is he going to say about my music? How is he going to interact with me? And he literally was one of the coolest, most loving, most supportive people that I've ever met, and one of the humblest. And so that really taught me that some of the most successful and impactful people on the planet are also the most humble. And that is something that can take you far, is having that deep humility and connection to our community while also being very steeped and deep in your greatness as well.
Yeah, and I would see him out and about just walking around Oakland in the Bay Area. He was so approachable. And I remember I was living in L.A. for a while, and then I moved back home. And when I saw him out and about, and I was like, Dwayne Wiggins is just walking around. Like, he's just, you know, he was very much invested in just being a part of the community. And he was, he's a legend.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Did you know, because we were all shocked, too. A lot of us were shocked when he passed away. Did you know he had been ill?
No. The last show that I went to that he did was at Yoshi's in this past December. Mm-hmm. And he was in great form, great spirits, very energetic, lively. He was even considering going to an after party I was going to at another venue after the concert. So he, seemed like his usual jovial, very energetic self. I always laughed working with them because I'm actually the same age as the group Tony, Tony, Tony. They were founded in 1987, 1988, and that's when I was born. Mm-hmm. And so on tour, like, he would always out party me. he would out party most of the people in the band. He really lived like a rock star. And so the last show that I saw him do, he seemed like he was in rare form and was just, enjoying and gratitude. And so I was really shocked when things just took an abrupt turn with his health. And he passed away so suddenly because I was not aware that he had cancer at that time.
Was that the last time you spoke to him at the Yoshi show?
No, we, continuously kept in contact. I actually had a show at the Chase Center for Black History Month, February 1st. And so that was actually like my first feature billboard for that show. And I sent him that. We talked about it. I was really excited. He was excited. And he said he was trying to come. And so we talked about that. He wasn't able to make it. And then his birthday was February 14th. So we did talk then. It was very brief. Mm-hmm. But we did speak then. And I didn't know that would be our last time talking.
Mm-hmm. He mentored you. What did you learn from him as an artist?
Well, the number one thing I learned from him as an artist is that no matter how successful you get, no matter how many accolades that you have, no matter how many great things that you've done, there's always still room to grow and to learn and to flourish. A lot of people, when we first started working together, asked him, why did he take me on as a protege and why was he invested in my career? And he said, because I want to learn from her. And I always laughed and, was shocked. But the more I think about that, the more wisdom I get from that is that that is how you stay fresh. That's how you stay true to your art. And that's how you stay great, is to continuously learn and grow and blossom. That's what keeps you continuously rising. In addition to that, just really understanding that you have to keep a high level of passion, to do it for the love of your art and what you do, and not necessarily for how much money you're going to make from it, but having that deep faith that if you put your work in, you put your 10,000 hours in, that mm-hmm. everything else will align to that. And also just really the deep levels of production, being able to do different shows with him in Oakland in different venues, and him working with me to produce some of my shows, but then also us going from doing a show on the back of a pickup truck for the East Bay Dragons 60th anniversary in Deep East Oakland to, we were doing a whole 30,000 people crowd at the Minnesota State Fair, the largest state fair in the world, like within 2 days, and knowing that whether it's a big stage or a small stage, you have to give the same level of performance, and that's what's going to keep you being great. And he was very intentional about always just staying connected to the reality of the community. No matter where we went and what we did. We're both from East Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. And so just continuously staying rooted in that community in a positive way was very essential to him remaining and retaining his authenticity as well.
Yeah, because when I was looking on social media and looking at the responses from people, and so many people, everyday people, people that aren't household names, had all these really just beautiful stories and encounters and how he supported them and would go to their poetry readings. And I mean, you know, he worked with major artists like Destiny's Child and her early in their careers, right? But he also too, mm-hmm. you know, local artists. He was there and just lifted local artists up here in the Bay Area and in Oakland. What was it like collaborating on songs together with him and his work ethic?
Oh man, his work ethic, like what I loved, and I think a thing that really connected me and him is that he really had a love and passion and drive for the work. And so anytime, even if we were just, you know, quote unquote, chilling, we were always working. We were always doing something. It's a part of our lifestyle, not just our profession. So it's something that, especially as an artist and art, our art is really a major part of our lifestyle. So I love that no matter what we were doing, we were always creating. Additionally, I just really appreciated he had a very gentle way of leading, to where it wasn't like intimidating, like, hey, my music career is older than you, but you know, I like what you're doing this way, but what about you thinking of that way? Mm-hmm. So he always nurtured in a way that uplifted you and inspired you. It was never like intimidating, because he could, you know, he had every right with all the millions of records that he sold and has helped other people to sell. He had every right to not really be that accommodating or understanding about others' ways of working or perspectives. But he always showed a lot of respect, a lot of humility, and also like put his heart and soul into making sure everything that we did had a certain standard of greatness, and that will forever live on through, you know, how he impacted me and how he impacted so many people, not just in music, but in so many facets of the creative industry in Oakland, in Atlanta, in Ghana, in Nigeria, and all over the world.
And as you mentioned, all these places all over the world, you toured with him, with Tony. What was that experience like? I can't even imagine someone like them asking me to tour with them. So, and as you're like a budding, growing artist, what was that like?
You know, it was very instantaneous is what I'll say, number one. It's funny that I actually, in 2018, I was at a gala with some students from a program that I was piloting in San Francisco. The gala happened to be on my birthday. Tony was performing, and somehow I wound up partying on stage with them for like their finale. Didn't know anybody of the group. It was a lot of photos that was taken. And then the way that things happened, within a year, I was touring with them. And literally the first show I did with him and the Tonys was at the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign rally, March of 2019. Mm-hmm. We had just got in the studio, and I thought he was just giving me, you know, a demo sample opportunity for this song, The Plant That Saved the Planet, that featured him and Rafael Sadiq. They collaborated on it, and there had been, you know, a long time coming from them having a collaboration. And so he said there was an open verse. And so I tried something, just something I wrote in the studio. He liked it. There was another artist who also worked with the Tonys, Frank Stickums, who he featured on it. And so I thought that's just what that was. He invited me to come with them to the Bernie Sanders show. I'm thinking I'm coming to spectate, to watch, to learn. And when they get there and get, you know, about to go on sound check, then he asked me, did I want to rock the song that we just did? I said, huh? It's 17,000 people. At Chrissy Field in San Francisco.
Wow.
And I, you know, in that moment, I'm like, well, definitely, let's do it, you know, because I'm, you know, about that life as well. And I did that, and we were literally, we started rocking from there. So it wasn't like we had an official meeting or I'd say an audition. It was more like he saw me in action, he identified with me in action, and he had that gut feeling, and we just started working from there.
Wow, that is amazing. That is amazing. What is his legacy? What do you think his legacy will be in Oakland when we look back at all he's done and, you know, at his presence?
Well, his legacy is one that will be everlasting. It'll be ever flowing. It is forever. I actually posted on Instagram today and I said, you know, the beat goes on and he'll forever be a part of our rhythm. He is someone that the impact that he made on Oakland, on Black music, and on the world of music and culture overall is one that will stand the test of time. He worked on a lot of different projects, but one that was especially near and dear to his heart was Timeless, the movie, which he was the executive producer of. Mm-hmm. He released it at the end of 2023 and had plans to, you know, market and promote it on a wider scale once he was, you know, getting through the 2020 reunion. That movie, Timeless, and just the concept of being timeless, I think is one that speaks the most to his legacy in terms of the music that him and the Tonys created, and also music that he helped other artists produce, are timeless classics that really can't be bound to a certain time frame or even genre per se. There are works that stand the test of time. And so I feel that his legacy is one that will continuously stand the test of time through all the people that he impacted in so many different ways. And also, you know, with his family, I gotta especially give love mm-hmm. to his family, who he cared a lot for and held really close and always showed up for them, in addition to showing up for the community at large and, you know, kind of being everywhere all at once. So he is someone who his legacy will continue to accrue interest, yeah. I feel. And he just set a mold that I hope and I do have faith that not just Oakland, but the Black music world will continue to carry forward.
Well, Queen Imena, thank you so much. Everybody listening, you can watch the gorgeous video for Queen Imena's song Oshun featuring Dwayne Wiggins on YouTube. Follow her on Instagram and we'll have a link on the Sights and Sounds page. Coming up, the artistic director of the San Francisco Ballet is here to talk about their upcoming show, Frankenstein. Keep it locked right here. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. English novelist Mary Shelley was just 19 years old when she finished writing the novel Frankenstein more than 200 years ago. The iconic horror story has been told in many iterations, including ballet. The San Francisco Ballet's production of Frankenstein opens tomorrow. Tamara Rohold is the artistic director of the San Francisco Ballet, and a few years ago she became the first woman to lead the company, so she's also a history maker too, and I'm so happy she's here. Hello, Tamara.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, I'm so happy you're here. I was reading your background, and you have such an amazing career, and I know you're going to blush because I'm just going to read about some of the things that you've done. You were artistic director of London's English National Ballet. You danced for 30 years as a professional ballerina. You've received high honors from leaders in Spain and the UK. The Kennedy Center gave you a gold medal. And yet, this all started because you accidentally stumbled into a ballet class when you were a little girl. And please tell the story. I know you said it a million times, but I just think it's just amazing.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have a mom that worked. And I feel it was very lucky for me because, you know, moms, you know, we always running around trying to catch up with things. And in one particular day, it was very rainy in Madrid, and Madrid can get cold. Mm-hmm. And I was waiting for my mom to pick me up after school. I was in the schoolyard. And a teacher saw me and she said, why don't you come into the gymnasium and just sit there? It's warm. We're doing ballet. And I had no idea what ballet was, but I stepped into that gymnasium and I fell in love with it straight away. And then my mom came to pick me up and I didn't want to leave. And I cried for 6 months until I convinced her that she had to allow me to do ballet.
You had never even seen a ballerina, never seen a ballet?
No, and it took me a while until I actually saw a performance. I thought that being a ballerina was becoming the teacher. Like you did the ballet class until you became the teacher. And that's what I said to everybody I wanted to do. And then my mom took me to see an actual performance and I didn't like it very much because I was quite an introvert. Mm-hmm. And the aspect of actually having to perform in front of people kind of threw me away. But I loved the practice so much. As a child, it was a safe space for me, a quiet space, an introverted space, a place where I could think clearly and feel my own emotions without having to express them to other people. And somehow it worked for me. And I know that for many people, ballet is that safe heaven.
And Tamar, I'm an extrovert, so.
Good for you. I think it's a much better thing to be.
But I'm just thinking about, and I have to say, I don't get shy, you know, when I get in front of people like I'm doing right now. But how did you move past that, you know, discomfort with performing in front of people? Were you able, when you were on stage, kind of just to just shut the theater out and just get lost in this world that you were performing in?
Yes, I think that's very much what I did. And I also love getting lost in the characters. Mm-hmm. I love performing characters that were very different to me. Quite outrageous character, murderous characters, you know, people that were really, really different and really, you know, extroverted in their feelings and just bigger than life. I kind of lived through them serendipitously. So in a way, it became, again, another amazing way of expressing myself through other people's lives, but it also became a way for me to understand other people and to empathize and sympathize with other people, even when they are perceived as wrong or perceived as different or perceived as alien to the norm. It kind of gave me a window into the mentality and the personalities of people that were different to me.
Does being an artistic director, I'm watching you and as you're thinking back to those roles that you perform and there's a smile on your face. Does being an artistic director and choreographer, because you do that as well, does that feed your passion for art differently than when you danced?
It's different in that, to be honest, it gives more pleasure because what you do is enable others to achieve that. And that's just the most enormous reward when you see young artists growing and developing and flourishing and sometimes doing things they didn't believe they could do themselves, or choreographers creating new works and you see the impact in the audience, or some of the work that we do with our communities. You know, the first time a child comes to the theater and sees a live performance and also an orchestra playing live for the first time, and they realize this could be a future for them. This could be a place where they could find their profession and their expression. I think the fact that I can make that happen is a lot more rewarding than the pleasure I got as an artist, which was a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you said when you were little, you were looking at the teacher and you saw yourself as a teacher, and in a way that's what you're doing too now too as well, you know, and inspiring future ballet dancers. And you mentioned earlier too about how you like playing different characters, even characters that maybe people don't understand, characters that have done wrong. And so that leads me to what we're talking about today, which is Frankenstein, the show that you all are doing that's opening tomorrow. And the photos and clips I've seen are beautiful. What does the audience get from Frankenstein being told through a ballet as opposed to like a film?
I mean, I think, like you say, our production is exquisite, so the visuals are extraordinary. But I think the thing about movement, which is the same with music, is that it crosses the limitations of language. So it doesn't matter how literate you might be or how familiar you might be with the original novel or you will feel it just by seeing these dancers perform it. You will feel it in your core, and in a way that I think gets much deeper through music and movement than any other art forms can achieve. In this particular case as well, Frankenstein, I feel, is always relevant, but never more than now when we see all these new technological developments. You know, we are creating new creatures, which is what the thing that Victor Frankenstein creates is a creature. We're creating new creatures that we don't understand ourselves. We don't know their power. We don't know the capability, but that's the story of humanity. We always forge ahead. We always take the risk. There's always someone that invents something that can get out of control. And I think, therefore, right now, looking back at the Industrial Revolution that inspired this and had so many positive outcomes, but so many tragic outcomes too, is a good exercise to do about what is the morality of moving forward without having a social conversation about the impact of what we are developing.
Mm-hmm. Which, and that just speaks to how timeless this story is. And one thing I noticed just in old clips I've seen of this production is that, you know, when we think of the creature in Frankenstein, he's very stiff. And so in the ballet, he's fluid, which I think is just, you know, really, really beautiful as far as how he moves. And this boundary between the creepiness and the grotesque. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think he's an overgrown baby. That's what he really is. He's a newborn baby that has no social norms, that no one has loved since he was created, that is trying to imitate what grown-ups do, is trying to fit in a world where he's not accepted. And his movement very often is childlike. He's full of wonder, he's full of the innocence of a child, he's full of that, you know, amazement. He sees somebody dance in a ballroom and he's just amazed and wants to be part of that. And then he's forever rejected and people are disgusted by him and there's nothing he can do about that. And as he slowly realizes that he will never be loved and he will never be accepted, he becomes monstrous. And so the physicality also reflects that. He goes from being almost childlike to being all-powerful, implacable, you know, destructive. Right. And again, that's the beauty of, I think, movement and music that can make you feel that physically. You see the transformation of this thing from something that could be a friend to something that is lethal.
Yes, it is. It's very lethal. I just remember from watching the movie. The costumes and the makeup, again, like I said, especially with the creature, the boundary of the creepiness and the beauty of it, and the goth. How long is the process as far as to get the creature made up, you know, in costume?
It's a very long process. We have an amazing team, a costume department and makeup department in San Francisco Valley, and they are top of the world. But just creature, it takes almost 2 hours. And the dancer has to be, because it's a full kind of costume, but then it has a bowl cup and then makeup throughout the face. So it's a complete transformation that the dancer has to go through. And sometimes it's, like you say, when you know those dancers and, you know, dancers are beautiful creatures and you suddenly see them transform into this beast, it's quite shocking the first time. They're unrecognizable. But it helps them also get lost into the character, this very strong transformation.
How long does it take to even prepare for something like this? Because it's dance and it's tech, and then again we're looking at very complicated makeup. So how long is the process? And is this a more challenging production to put on compared to like traditional productions?
This is a very big production. It involves the whole company, the entire corps de ballet, all of the dancers. So in terms of rehearsal process, it's one of the longest. It took 4 weeks just to kind of learn the steps and rehearse them. And then we've been doing a stage rehearsals and makeup rehearsals and costume rehearsals for another 2 weeks. So in total is 6 weeks of work of a production that already existed and we had already performed. I think if we were to create a new piece, that takes about 12 weeks at least. Mm-hmm. But even to revive it is half that time, just because of the amount of people and the amount of detail. You know, the sets are just overwhelmingly beautiful, but they're big. So they take a whole team of backstage experts and craftsmanship to, you know, put it together. And so it is a lot of work. It's a big investment on our part, but I think the piece is worth it. I think it deserves it.
Do you like taking on challenging pieces like that?
I love it. I loved it as a dancer, as I said before. I love it for the dancers to be pushed to discover their new boundaries, you know, where is it my next boundary? What is it the thing that I can do that I had never done before? And I also love it for the audience. I think the whole experience of attending a performance should be an overwhelming one. It cannot be timid. It has to either move you or make you laugh or you know, or shock you. And in this case, I think this piece does all of it.
Mm-hmm. You talked about, you know, being up for the challenge and doing new things. And so you've been the artistic director for a few years now. And you're the first woman to take on this role. What have you learned about yourself?
This is actually my second season. I've been director for 2.5 years now. What I have learned about myself, I think that I am resilient. I guess, you know, my whole career was in Europe. One of the reasons I wanted to come to San Francisco Ballet was to learn, to continue to evolve. I think, like Queen was saying before, you know, to challenge myself, to keep learning, to do things I've never done before and to work with people I have never worked before. And all of that has been a reality since the first day I came here. But it's also just been incredibly rewarding how hungry the artist and the audience were for change and for new things and new ideas. And that's the best when you feel like you're pushing, but to an open door, that people actually are looking forward to be shocked, surprised, overwhelmed, whatever it might be. But it has been, you know, a lot of learning on my behalf, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, Tamara, I can't wait to see the show. I'm going to see it. So,
great.
Because you all sold me with the photos. congratulations. And please come back. You are more than welcome to come back anytime and talk about what else the San Francisco Ballet is up to.
That's very kind. Thank you. I definitely will take that.
All right. Thank you. Tamara Rojo is the artistic director of the San Francisco Ballet. Their production of Frankenstein opens tomorrow, Thursday, and runs through March 26th. And if you miss those dates, like I will, they'll return for an encore run from April 26th to May 4th. And coming up, an Oakland author talks about why she wants kids today to know about Star Trek actress Nichelle Nichols. Don't beam up anywhere. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. Hailing frequencies open, Captain. I've always wanted to say that. Fans of Star Trek, the original series, are familiar with this line by Lieutenant Uhura. The legendary actress Nichelle Nichols portrayed the communications officer on the 60s show and in the Star Trek films. That role not only changed Miss Nichols' life, but she inspired Black people, people of color, and women to go into science. And back then, she was one of the few Black women on screen not playing stereotypical roles like maids. Still, she faced many challenges due to racism and sexism, but overcame them. Angela Dalton is a children's book author based in Oakland. Her book is To Boldly Go, How Nichelle Nichols and Star Trek Helped Advance Civil Rights. Angela and I spoke about why she wants kids to learn about the late actress. Angela Dalton, welcome!
Hi! Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited that you're here. I saw your book And it's such a cute book and just a very important book. But let's go back before the book to Boligo. When and how did you get into Star Trek?
So I had a father who was a technophile. He loved like electronics. He loved gadgets. He loved everything. So as soon as something came out, we had it, like VHS, beta, Laserdisc. I see now I'm like probably aging myself, but we had it. And so, and part of that was like fueled by my cousin's husband. So my cousin Steve and my dad, like both of them were way into technology, which then kind of flowed into sci-fi. And Star Trek came on Saturday night, and it was like the only night that my dad would allow me to have Kool-Aid because it was so much sugar and I would bounce off the walls. So it was like Saturday night Kool-Aid and watching Star Trek, because my cousin Steve was like, you need to let her watch this show. And it was the original Star Trek. And so, you know, watching, like I have very clear, vivid memories of just sitting in front of the TV, getting excited, waiting for that opening monologue, you know, to boldly go where no man has ever gone before. And just turning and seeing my parents, you know, as Black people, as Black couple, and just really remembering like the look on my mother's face, seeing Lieutenant Uhura. There was a pride there. There was, you know, there was a happiness, a joyfulness there of seeing this woman with these men being, you know, having agency and having the skill set. And then like, of course, like my dad, you know, like what man did not like Lieutenant Uhura? Like, you know, just him watching him like in her little white go-go boots, you know, like he was just like, you could see like this love, affection for this Black woman on television. But it wasn't until I was, you know, older that I really understood what that meant for them as Black people in America to be watching this show. So that was really, as a kid, like that is what opened up my whole world to like, there are life forms beyond what we've got here, that the social structures of, you know, how we treat each other in America on this earth and what could be possible. And so it just really started a lifelong love for myself and like space exploration and NASA, and I wanted to be an astronaut, but I was claustrophobic, so that didn't work out for me. But but that's the earliest memory. I was probably like 8 or 10 watching those reruns and really remembering not wanting to miss them because they meant so much, seeing Nichelle Nichols as Lieutenant Uhura.
What about Nichelle Nichols appealed to you?
She had style, you know, she came out with some earrings, just like, bam, bam. You know, like I said, she had her red, you know, her red commander's outfit. And she just had a presence about her that you didn't really see that often when I was growing up. You know, there was just like, she, like I said, she was given agency. People came to her for solutions and she always had the solutions. Like she voiced her opinions, whether people wanted to hear them or not. And so to see a woman, especially a Black woman, to hold herself in that kind of presence and not be played with, you know, I was like, that's the kind of Black woman I want to be.
I've read Nichelle Nichols' autobiography, and I think it's out of print, but for people listening, I definitely recommend that you read her autobiography, as well as your book, too, as well, To Boldly Go. And going back to what you were saying as far as like the type of woman she was and the type of Black woman she was on that show and having agency, and you see that in her real life. I mean, she was not only an actress, she was a dancer. She started off in ballet. That's what her passion was initially.
Classical ballet.
She was a singer. She was an activist, author. I mean, she was so many things and overcame so many hurdles. The networks didn't want her to read the fan mail she was getting, or, you know, they were hiding it. I mean, she went through a lot. She went through a lot. And that's just a little minor, you know, part of some of the things that she encountered. So it was really amazing that you were able to put so much about her in this children's book.
Thank you. It was hard. It was really hard. Because like you said, there were so many things that she went through, so many microaggressions on the, you know, the lot, the production lot of the TV show. But even taking like the piece of Star Trek away from it, like you said, like she was a performer. She was a really well-known performer. She was traveling around the country, traveling around the world. There were situations that she was put in that I think would break most people. I remember reading, I don't know if you remember this, when she was in, I think it was Canada.
Oh yeah, I remember that story.
It was like she had been harassed, she had been assaulted. And it was by
and kidnapped.
Kidnapped and assaulted by somebody who's basically like the Canadian mafia. She took them to court. And, you know, and this was probably like, I think in the 50s, 60s when this happened, where, you know, for a Black woman to take someone of that power, of that stature to court for assault and win was, you know, incredible. It was unheard of. So it was really hard to pick out, okay, like what's child appropriate and what ties into, you know, her legacy in a way that, you know, it shows that she was human. Because she was a human person. She left, she quit Star Trek because she could not take it anymore. And, you know, luckily there were influences and people who could hold up a mirror like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that showed her that she had the strength to go back and to stay in that situation because it was important. It wasn't fun. It didn't get better. It, you know, like it still was really difficult for her to be a Black woman, a Black actress on the lot. And she, like you said, she was treated so horribly. She was not paid the same. They messed with her contracts. They wouldn't give her her fan mail. But she went back and because she knew that it was important for Black people, for our people to see her in that position.
And going back to Martin Luther King, people that listen to me know I love Afrofuturism. And to know that Martin Luther King was Afrofuturist and told her, you can't quit because we have to see ourselves in the future. That's part of being an activist, too, is seeing a better future, a hope for a better future. So I thought that was deep when he met her and told her that. And like I think that was the only show he would allow his kids stay up late to watch or something like that.
That's right.
What are a few key things that you want kids, when they read this book, to know about Nichelle Nichols?
I think first and foremost, I love when they can see or if they can see that to make a change doesn't mean you have to make a grand gesture. You don't have to do a big thing. You know, she didn't go on this show to be an activist. She turned into an activist because of the experience. But I hope that they see that, like, just her presence had this seismic, these seismic rings of change, right? From being on Star Trek, even though Star Trek ended, her story didn't end there. You know, there was a good 10 years until the first orbital shuttle was created by NASA. And that was significant in space exploration because up until then, they were space rockets that had been controlled by the astronauts that were in the rocket. So for that reason, NASA believed that the only people who could pilot a rocket were fighter pilots who were in the military, who were military trained. And of course, because of discrimination, that meant only white men. So with the orbiter that was created, the space shuttle that was created in 1976, I believe, what that meant was that it was controlled by the space control on the ground. So that meant anybody could be an astronaut. And that's what NASA wanted to do. They wanted to open up this field to more diversity because they were under government scrutiny for discrimination. So it was like, they had to do this. It wasn't that they were like just doing it to be nice. They were like forced to diversify. But it meant that like doctors could do it. Educators could become astronauts. Like literally anybody could become an astronaut. So when they went out to try to recruit candidates, they had a really hard time because they were not trusted. They were not a trusted government organization. And so, you know, they turned to Nichelle Nichols, who they knew was beloved and who that people respected and admired, and asked her to help with recruiting to diversify their astronaut program. And I love telling the story where, like, you know, when NASA had tried to do it, they had 1,400 candidates. But a lot of them were white males. Like they didn't read the fine print to know that this was supposed to be for like women and for minorized people. And so when Nichelle Nichols went out to do her campaign, they only gave her 6 months because they had to hit a certain date. And they had burned through like a bunch of their budget. They'd burned through a lot of their time. She like hit every news organization, every college, every university. Like she put her face out there to say like space is for everyone. And by the time she was done, she had 8,000 qualified candidates. And so that just showed the power of her platform.
Wow.
So, you know, it's like things like that, that I want kids to see that, like, just her showing herself, just her being herself, just her, you know, taking on this role, even though it wasn't comfortable, she made a change, and that they can do that too, that we all have the power to do that, of just showing up, can have seismic rings of change.
Yeah. And, you know, and I'm thinking about Hidden Figures, the book and the movie. And I find it interesting that this Black woman helped recruit so many future astronauts. And at a time when we didn't know about Hidden Figures, and we didn't know that there were these Black women who were mathematicians, you know, who helped us get to the moon and all that stuff, you know, so which is really fascinating, just to show like women, Black women, we've been part of astronomy, you know, for a long time. I was at a Star Trek convention in January, and I know you missed it because you weren't feeling well, and your publicist, and we missed you, your publicist, Audrey, who I'm friends with, was selling your book. And Angela, people were flocking to the table for copies of your book. And I thought how people, after all these years and all these decades, they still love Nichelle Nichols. And she's, you know, no longer with us, but people still love her. And there were celebrities taking photos with your book. Celia Rose Gooding, who plays Uhura now in Strange New Worlds. Anson Mount, who's the captain on Strange New Worlds, bought a book for his kid. I saw him do that. And a few of the actors from Star Trek Discovery, Sonequa Martin-Green and David Ajala, who played Captain Michael Burnham in book. That's my captain's Michael Burnham. But I love Captain
That's
Michael.
Right.
That's a whole nother show. I could do a whole series on why I love Captain Michael Burnham. But
seriously.
And I love Sonequa. Ooh. I love Sonequa. And David Ajala. And David Ajala hugged me. That's a whole nother show. I'm still holding on to that. And Sonequa is strong. She a little woman. But we had this really touching moment where we talked, and then when it was time for me to take my picture, she grabbed me and I was like, oh.
I'm so jealous.
That's okay. When they come back. But anyway, how did it feel when you saw those actors holding your book? How did that feel?
I cried. It was a terrible little time to take a booster shot because that's what took me down. I cried. First of all, like, I need to give just an immense shout out of gratitude to Audrey T. Williams, my publicist, because she was the one who said, you know, this is happening, you need to be there. And I said, I can't. I'm just like, and she's like, I'll do it for you. And so she really was the one who got the book in front of people. And she sent me the pictures and the videos. And again, the legacy of this TV show, of this woman that's now like 50 plus years later and still making an impact, like you said, even in her absence, of seeing these Black women who get to now stand in her shoes in this character, holding my book, is just like, whew, I was not prepared for that because that's not why I wrote the book. I wrote the book as a, you know, my love letter to Nichelle Nichols and to Black women and to Black girls and to Black people, of like, this is a woman who, like, you know, stood for us. And so now to see that it has, I mean, it's always like what writing books is like. You write your book, you do it the best you can, you put your intention into it and write it because you want to write it, because you don't see it out there, because I had not seen any book about Nichelle Nichols out in the industry. And so to see how far and wide this book has traveled, like, I've gotten to meet Marion Smothers, Nichelle Nichols' sister, who's now continuing her legacy with Steam Heroes Foundation, to be so welcomed into kind of the Star Trek family. Gene Roddenberry's son, Rod Roddenberry, he read the book and he was just so complimentary about how his father would have loved how I handled the material and told the story, and especially highlighting Nichelle because, you know, like, she was one of his greatest friends.
Last question. You've written several books. What's the best compliment you've received from a kid about your books?
Oh, you're gonna make me cry. I don't know if it wasn't necessarily a compliment about my book, but I was in Seattle, Washington for a for school visit. It was a really big school visit. It was like, it was one of the first big ones that I had. I think there was maybe 700 kids. And so as they were coming to the lunchroom, the cafeteria, one of the very first kids was this beautiful Black boy with like Harry Potter glasses, dreadlocks. The librarian had kind of pulled me aside and she was like, you know, we're seating kids who have special needs in the front, just so you know. And I was like, okay, that's fine. So he was in that class. And as they sat down, he looked up at me and he said, you look just like me. You look like me. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, and you wrote this book? And I said, yes, I wrote this book. I wrote some other books. And he's like, I can write books? And I'm like, yes, we can write books. And that was exactly why I do this. Because when I was his age, I too didn't have people that I saw that looked like me who were telling our stories, writing our books. I didn't even see me in the books themselves. And so to have him reflect to me that, like, oh, wait, you did it. You made it. You're here. And now you're passing it on to other kids because you're standing here in front of them to show them that they can do it too. Like, that is better than any compliment and any job and any salary that you can get, is like knowing that, like, there's some child who understands, like, their voice means something.
That was children's author Angela Dalton. Her book, To Boldly Go, How Nichelle Nichols and Star Trek Helped Advance Civil Rights, is available now, and you can get it at your local bookstore. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. If you're on the road or on BART, I hope you get home safe. And we'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.